This is Tape 5, Side A of the Open University course, English 102, Composition in Native Indian Literature 1. On this tape, course author Patty Hartford talks to Vicki Sears, the author of Grace. This interview was recorded at the Open Learning Agency in Burnaby on February 16, 1993. Vicki Sears is in Seattle, and Patty Hartford is at her home in Kamloops. This interview begins with Vicki making an announcement.
I just had a wonderful thing happen.
What's that?
The people from the PBS station in Portland just called me to tell me that they want to do a film of Dancer.
How exciting.
Yes.
Oh.
Like, I can't. It's wonderful.
And
very exciting news.
Did you solicit this at all, or did they just sort of call you?
Now, who did they tell me? Oh, gosh. Gloria Bird told me to call me. Gloria Bird is a Native poet who teaches at the Art Institute in Albuquerque, Indian Art Institute, down there. So she told them.
You're becoming famous.
Oh, my goodness. I don't think I'm becoming famous, but I think Indians read other Indians. So that's kind of exciting.
Hey? I think that's exciting.
And yes.
That just gives our students one more thing to look for here if it comes north of the border. Well, I know that you have been busy juggling your life between two careers,
mm-hmm.
and I'm interested to know when and how you started writing.
I started to write when I was about 5. One thing that I have to be grateful to my mother for is that she did teach me how to read. before I went to school. And when I went to Washington Children's Home, my parents got divorced, and my father was a full blood, and my mother is Spanish and English, and they declared both of them unfit. My father was alcoholic. My mother is also alcoholic, but she was also cohabitating with another person. And back in the late 40s, that was a real no-no. So they both declared unfit parents, and that's where my brother and I went. And I started to write as a way to sort of remember the things that my grandmother told me,
mm-hmm.
and the things that my father had taught me. And my mother is not in touch at all with her own culture. So I didn't have anything particularly that I was saving from her, but just stories and things, and that's how I started writing. So I was 5 and 6.
And did you keep that up pretty consistently?
I stopped doing it when this woman that I call Ichabod, who's in the story Grace, found my notebook and not only tore it up, but read parts of it to other kids, and I was the brunt of a lot of humor, a lot of teasing. So I stopped that for
and when did you pick
some
it up
time.
Again?
Pardon me?
When did you pick it up again?
When I was about 12 or 13, and I consistently wrote after that all the time. I never shared it with anybody. But I wrote all the time, and I wanted to be a writer. I mean, I knew from the time I was very young that that's what I wanted. So I just kept moving.
And now they're making movie, television productions of your work.
It's kind of mind-boggling.
I know that you write about things that happen to you personally.
Mm-hmm.
Is all of your work as personally related as Grace is?
I think that there are elements of myself in almost everything that I write. I think one thing that I really say to young people when they're thinking about writing, or anybody of any age when they're thinking about writing, is write about what you know. And whether it's life on the reserve or it's being a breed who lives in the city, write about what you know. And so there's always some elements of myself. Every once in a while, there'll be something that totally is unrelated to me. I can think of one story that about a woman named Sadie who recycles staples. And she's just a character that I knew here in the U District, and just was so such a fascinating person that I had to write about her.
Well, I can understand that.
Yeah.
So generally, it's your own experiences and people who have touched your life in some
mm-hmm.
way.
Okay. Generally.
What do you think is the most important thing for Native people to write about?
I think about the things that they see around them, the things that impact their own spirit, the things that make them want to say, this ought to be a piece of beauty that's seen by other people, or this ought to be a piece of pain that's heard by other people so it'll stop. I can't separate my body, my mind, and my spirit from my political self. And my political self is that of an Indian. And I think a lot of what I write is political, whether it's about child abuse or some other kind of injustice that I see. I mean, I think that that's a big piece of who I am. I mean, besides being a product of the 60s, you know, anti-war and civil rights movements. But that's what I think people ought to be writing about. And it doesn't all have to be done with doom and gloom either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would hope it wouldn't be, as a matter of fact, but that's primarily what I think people should write about.
I'd like to come back to part of that later.
Okay.
What's your feeling about non-Native writers writing fiction about Native people? Be honest here.
Be honest here, eh? I get very angry at people like William Kinsella. I think he made his book Moxon Telegraph is filled with absolutely tons of stereotypes. I think he has an ear for some Indian rhythms sometimes, but he makes me very angry because he's earned a lot of money. It's like pony stealing, any kind of pony stealing. And I think it's wrong. I think that I'm going to be really upfront here. I have a lot of sadness sometimes for Anglo people because there are people who are lost. When I see people becoming mooses and elks and things like that, you know, I go, they do this because they've lost their cultures in coming to America. They may not have had theirs battered out of them like we did as Native people, but they lost themselves. And they keep trying to take from us because we still have identity. And it makes me sad. It makes me sad for them, and it makes me angry that they are putting impressions out there that oftentimes don't have much to do with what an Indian really feels, with how they observe the world. I mean, the world viewers are very, very different. And people will read Kinsella because of Shoeless Joe, you know, his other major work. And it makes me very angry, quite frankly.
Well, we know who your favorite writer is not.
Yes.
Who do you like to read?
Who do I like to read? Well, now here comes a true confession. I love mysteries. I like a woman named Karen Kajewski, Sue Grafton. I love Emily Bronte. I love Joe Bruschak, Ali Akta. She's a Cherokee poet that's wonderful. I like... I've forgotten her first name, Cullerton, the woman who wrote April Rain Tree. I think it's a fine book.
Mm-hmm. Beatrice Cullerton.
Hmm?
Beatrice Cullerton.
Beatrice, yes. I like Elizabeth Lynn Cook. I love Beth Brandt. I love Leanne Howe. And I really like Paula Gunn Allen's poetry in particular. Sometimes she gets a little too academic for me. I like her writing. I loved Woman Who Owned the Shadows. I just think it was a wonderful. I like Gerald Visner a great deal. Jim Welch at his very best, like, the one about the Fool's Crow. I think Fool's Crow is a stunning book. I like him very much. I think those are my favorite writers.
You're giving me a lot of food for thought here. I'm going to rush out to my library. What do you think is your best work?
My best work? I think I have two pieces that I like really, really well. One of them is Grace, and the other is Dancer. Dancer is about a foster child that I had who's now living at Rocky Boy and doing quite well. And I had her from the time she was 4 until she was 13. And while her mom was in jail. And she was a wonderful kid. So I think I like those two pieces best. And I like a poem really well that's called Nagasaki Elder, which is about a woman who was one of my clients at a community clinic, because I'm a social worker, and her entire body was a patchwork quilt of her own skin that had been melted on the day the bomb was dropped in Nagasaki. And of course, I asked her permission if I could try to publish that poem. And I can't read that without crying. And that woman has always been a very big piece in my life of what war is about, what people not thinking about long-term impacts are about. So I like that poem very much. I don't think I'm as good a poet as I am a short story writer.
I haven't read any of your poetry, but I'm anxious now.
Oh.
What have other people said about your work? Peers, your critics, family, whoever?
My family are not readers, so I'm sort of the oddball in the family. They just don't read, so they've said nothing. As a matter of fact, I don't even know if they know if I have anything published or not. Critics, by and large, have tended to be pretty generous to me. I think Kinsella is a real exception. He found my work, with the exception of Grace, I think, totally dull and boring. But most of those critics have been fairly good. I think that Grace has been a story that they've liked a lot, and I feel very lucky because it's a chapter out of the middle of my novel, so I feel hopeful. I think people, one of the things that they've commented about is how different the voices are that I've been able to write, which I feel real blessed at being able to do. And that's just because I like different voices, and I've lived in lots of different places, and so I got to hear a lot of different kinds of sounds, and that's been a great blessing to me. The thing that has excited me the most is that Simple Songs, which is a collection of short stories, has gotten wonderful crossover reviews for young adult readers. And I can't think of an audience I'd rather reach than young people. So I feel very, very blessed to have been able to do that. Let's see. One person in L.A. Said that the first 75 pages of Simple Song weren't worth reading at all. And I was kind of like surprised, because one of the stories...
How many are there in this book?
How many stories are there in the book?
How many pages?
Let's see. I'm looking at it right now. 165. So I went, ooh, ouch.
How do you react when somebody says this kind of thing about your work? Do you just get angry, or do you just go out to prove them wrong, or what do you do?
Well, I really read the reviews. I tend not to try to take them in personally, but I read them enough to say, well, now, let's see what's valid in them. How well did they read the book? So that they did they really read the story, or was it a skim through? You know, so I try to pay that much attention. I try not to allow myself to get really hurt by them. I did when I very first started getting reviewed, but I realized that, you know, the story doesn't belong to you. Once you've written it and put it out there, it belongs to everybody else, and everybody's going to have their different impressions about it. I was standing in a line to go into a concert, and there was these two young women standing in front of me, and they were talking about a piece of poetry that I had written, and they had the most fascinating interpretations. And I was going, that's not what that poem is about at all, inside of my head. But it doesn't belong to me anymore. So it's like you give it away. I try to pay enough attention to see if there's valid criticism and what I can do to make my writing better. You know, but I do that all the time on my own. I mean, I'm always trying to be better. That's really what I want, is to be a good writer. You know, that obviously that makes sense.
It makes wonderful sense, but why don't we have you read from some of that good writing, just whichever passage you'd like.
From Grace? Mm-hmm. Let's see. There's a section in the story. You did ask me a question the other day that I wanted to answer.
Sure.
When I wrote Grace, I was in therapy, and it was the first time in my life that I was ever talking about being in an orphanage or being in foster homes, because it was a subject of tremendous shame. It made me very different, and it was like the other kids made it real clear it was not acceptable behavior, you know. So it's like, ooh, okay. And I was trying to tell my therapist that I wanted to tell my real mother some of the things that had happened to me in the orphanage and in the foster homes, and because she's not a person who listens to things. And my therapist said, why don't you tell your real mother? And I said, who's that? Because I had a lot of different foster parents. And she said, why don't you tell Grace? Grace was the only Indian foster home I ever got, that my brother and I got. And I did not know that Grace and Paul really truly were their names until I got the orphanage records about 3 years after I wrote the story. And then from the story began a whole novel about what happened to my brother and myself. And I fictionalized it because of lawsuits. You can be sued pretty easily, and you don't, it's, they have to, the people like Washington Children's Home would have to be the people who proved that you were lying or something, but I just didn't want to get involved with it, so I sort of fictionalized it. But basically, it's what happened to us. So, and then later on, I realized that calling it Grace had a whole lot of significance that I wasn't aware of at the original time, but became aware of since. So that sort of sets it up. My brother and I were putting in a garden, and it was the first time we'd ever dealt with plants any other way than collecting them as medicine. I mean, we didn't plant things, you know. And then Grace says, let's see, I'll start from here. It's a, I have to change voices, okay, because this is a 9-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
We spent a long time doing gardening. The dirt felt good, like stirred up rain smells. We ate lunch by the garden, and Grace said, "I think we deserve a walk. Let's go down by the river, kids." Down to the river, Grace showed us different plants and birds. She knew a lot about birds. She told us the songs by making whistles through her teeth. She tried to show us to do whistles with grass between her thumbs, but I think my teeth weren't big enough. Billy Jim didn't have a tooth in the front, so he couldn't do it either. She showed us these grasses, too, that she said she made baskets, and we picked some. When we got back to the house, she put them in a big round pan, like for taking baths, and filled it up with water. That night, she bit some grass apart with her teeth and showed me how to weave them in a basket. She thought I didn't know how to do this, but my grandmother already showed me before. I forgot some, though, and my basket wasn't so good. She said, "You'll get better." Grace read a story to us. Then Billy Jim and me went to bed. When I was going to sleep, I thought on her telling me about birds. One morning time, I woke up extra early. The house was all quiet, and I thought to go see some birds. I got dressed and went real soft down the stairs. I stopped on hearing noises in the kitchen. I crept up to the door and saw Grace putting water in the coffee pot, then poking embers in the stove. She went back to the sink and stood in the new sun coming in the window. She took one hand in the other and rubbed her swollen up knuckles and all slow up and down her fingers. She put some stuff that smelled like Vicks on her hands and slow rubbed her knuckles. Then she opened and closed her hands over and over and rubbed more. Grace looked out the window the whole time, making a little smile while she was rubbing on her fingers. It seemed like she'd done that lots of times before, so I stood still. I didn't want her to see me because the sun was nice on her skin and shining in her hair, kind of like baby rainbows. I just wanted to watch. I did that for a while, then made sounds like I was first coming down the stairs. Grace said, "You're up very early, Jody." I said, "I wanted to go see some birds and stuff." She said, "If you want to come with me, I'll show you something magic." She reached out her hand, but I put both arms behind my back and took hold of my own hands. She smiled and opened the door. "We'll take a walk over to the alfalfa. I want to show you some colors." We walked between the wheat and alfalfa, the air swollen up with their sweetness. Grace pulled down a piece of alfalfa and said, "Smell." It was all sharp and tickled inside my nose, kind of like medicine. It had dew on it, and the wetness landed on my cheek. Grace got some on her nose. I wanted to touch it, but I didn't. Grace said, "See the different colors?" She ran a finger down the alfalfa, and I saw there was places where it was real dark, then lighter, then sort of like limes are colored. I always thought it was all one color, but I was fooled. Grace did the same thing with the wheat and said, "And here's something else that's wonderful. Look what happens when the sun comes to the plants." Grace moved them around, and I saw that the light changed the colors, too. It's almost like you can look right through them. I guess I'll just stop there, eh?
I love the imagery there. I'm so glad you chose that passage.
Oh, thank you.
You were talking before you read, I wondered if you had ever talked to Grace or contacted her in any way after writing the story.
I tried to. When I got the records from the orphanage, they had obliterated their last names and their address. And when I first moved back to Washington after having lived in Virginia for a while, I looked and looked and couldn't find the farm. And I wasn't sure whether that was their real names, but when I got the records, the names were gone. So I tried to. There is a story in Simple Songs called Music Lady, which is about a record store that I used to run to from the orphanage all the time. And where the woman taught me about mixing music and stories together. Like, she introduced me to Peter and the Wolf, and it was like total magic, you know. And I did write a story about those experiences and was able to give the story to Mrs. Smith. And it was so wonderful to be able to give that to that person who was such a breath in my childhood. Well, it was amazing to me.
I've wondered, too, what your brother's reaction has been to the story.
My brother and I don't... One of the things that happened in the orphanage was he simply disappeared one day. And he was adopted. It turned out he was adopted by my father's oldest sister. He disappeared, and I think we were 9, and that would have made him 8. And I did not see him again until I was 11 years old. I may have been 8 and he may have been 7. And by that time, a lot of time had passed, and I did not see him again until he was 24. So we did not get to grow up with each other, and we have a lot of just great sadness.
And differences, I imagine, too.
Pardon me?
And differences, I imagine, too.
Very many differences. My brother is not a reader. We have very different lifestyles. And a part for me that's very sad is that he's very homophobic. And I made a decision when I was in my late 30s that I was a lesbian. And that has been very uncomfortable for him. And I can't do anything about it. He won't accept me at this point. So it's a great loss.
It is. It's a wonderful story, and it's something that probably would be a real bonding characteristic between you, and it's unfortunate. I have some questions about the story itself.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the longer work from which Grace is taken or which it has developed into or is developing into. Has it been published?
Hasn't been published. It's at Ballantine right now. And hopefully they'll like it. I hope they will. It's called One of Them Kids. And in the orphanage, they used to display the kids all the time when people like the Shriners and big organizations like that would come, and they would give free ticket to the orphans and what they would do. And I never felt like I was an orphan. I mean, I knew I had a family, and it was pretty puzzling to me. But they would set us all in one section, and then they would shine this huge light on us and say, we are very pleased to have the children from the, you know, Washington Children's Home Society here. Give a hand to the orphans. Or you'd go in early to the performances and you had a special colored ticket because it was one of the freebie tickets. And I remember this ticket taker answering this woman's question. She said, why do those children get to go in first? And I just happened to be the one that was passing him when he said it. And he said, oh, she's one of them kids, you know, the orphans. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I called the book that. And I think the book has pain. It is not an uncommon story for Native people to have been separated from their families. And when I read the records now, I know that there was a lot of racism involved in the story, or in the divorce, rather, because my father had, I think, 5 sisters and 1 brother, and I could have been adopted by any of them, as he had a large extended family. But, you know, it's the way Washington State looked at Indian families and Indian child-rearing practices. So we were taken away. And it does have racism. It has pain. It has some sexual abuse in it. And it also has what I think is the most magnificent quality that I've ever seen and that is the capacity of children to survive and to still see beauty around them. And I don't think that that's unusual to myself either. So that's why I decided to write the book. And hopefully I'll reach a lot of people. I don't care what nationality they are or ethnic group they are, but I hope I'll reach a lot of people who were separated or wound up in foster homes and stuff, and have people know, you know, they weren't alone.
As I used this story in a class I was teaching on our reserve here in Kamloops, students were so moved to tears and said, I've experienced that too, or so many of them shared your experience in some way, not in its entirety maybe, but in some way, and they loved the story, not because of its happy content, but I think because they picked up on that feeling of hope, and because they could share in your experience, and I think that non-Native readers pick up on those same feelings and identify very, very well with the feelings that Native people have been subjected to. And so I think your ambitions for this story are definitely being realized.
God, that's exciting to me. I think one of the most happy experiences for me is having gotten good crossover reviews by the National Library Association and stuff to Grace and some of the other short stories, you know, for kids. It's just, and I'm working now on writing. There are lots of books for kids 6 and up, but there are no books for preschoolers about going to foster homes. And so I'm working on a preschooler book on what it means to go to a foster home.
Now, I know that you work as a counselor, as a psychotherapist, as well as a writer. Tell me about your background and what brought you to this kind of combination.
It's kind of strange, isn't it? Actually, when I was little and I was living in the orphanage, I used to say to myself, when I grow up, I'm going to marry a plumber. Somehow I knew they had money. And I'm going to marry a plumber, and I'm going to have a great big house where all the children who are not wanted by anybody get to live. And that's probably why I've had 32 foster children, as part of fulfilling that life fantasy. I started off as a school teacher, as a high school teacher, and I just kept getting kids drawn around me all the time, and I decided to leave the city and go back to the woods, and went to work at a tree farm, and suddenly began to just have kids drawn to me, and wound up writing a drug and alcohol program, runaway program, things like that. And I just sort of became a social worker by accident, eventually going back to school and becoming a certified alcoholism drug counselor, and as well as a social worker. And I can't think of anything I would rather do than do that if I have to, you know, earn my living, which obviously one does, because you don't make much money as a writer unless you get very, very famous. Or unless you're a formula writer like Danielle Steele or Michener or somebody like that. And so that's what happened. And I think my own distress growing up lent me to being a social worker, lent me to having a particular kind of understanding about some of the pain that people experienced, and I guess that's how it happened.
And now you share it as you write I think it is an interesting but a really exciting combination, and you do it well.
Mm, thank you.
I really have enjoyed talking to you. I wish we could just go on and on.
Okay.
But I do appreciate your time, and I really appreciate the story.
Well, thank you very much. I do want to answer the question that you asked me the other day about what advice.
Yes.
One of them is to always write about what you know, and which I know I said before. Mm-hmm. The other thing is if you start a story or if you start a novel or a poem, don't stop and edit it. Just keep writing until it's all out. And interesting enough, it often will make itself, and it'll surprise you. I mean, it'll often tell you things you didn't even know about yourself. But it's real important to not stop and try to perfectionalize it somehow while you're in the writing process. You know, once you're done with it, leave it alone, a couple, 3 days, 4 days, whatever. Go back and then do some editing. But you'll find out you know a lot. And the other thing is to read out loud to yourself. When you read out loud, you hear things that you can't hear just by using your eyes. That is often difficult for me because I am losing my vision. But I have people read to me and before I try to fix a story, because if a sentence doesn't work out loud, it doesn't work on the paper. You know? And so those are things that I think are really super important to pay attention to with the writing.
I think we probably have a lot of students who, in reading some of the stories from this course, will want to try their own writing, and I think your advice will be very valuable.
Oh, good.
Thank you again, Vicki.
You're
really
welcome.
Appreciate it.
You take good care, eh?
Okay. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.